5 set. 1 through 5. If you agree, please.
My name is Clancy, I'm a former alcoholic. Now that you had an hour and a half away from my groaning voice, we'll try it again. Well, it's something we talk about the steps. I should say going in that I am not in that school of thought. There are people who are able to talk about the steps and their deep psychological meaning and what they really mean. But I'm not one of those. I'm one of those people who, I'm a subscriber to what Dr. Bob said, to keep it simple. And to me, the simplicity of the alcoholics down to 12 steps, the reason we have to make them complex when we're new is because we're so complex we can't believe that simple program like that can help us. But as you stay sober longer, it gets simpler and simpler as you develop various reactions. I would say that in my opinion of the steps I know, the first three steps have probably kept more people drunk than anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, probably, in my opinion, in my experience, because people come here and the first three steps just are not, that makes sense, because the first step you're going to admit you're an alcoholic, I'm not really an alcoholic, then you're going to return to God, and if you're like me, I don't want to return to God, I want to stay out of sight if possible. Then you're going to turn your problems over to God and try that some morning when you can't pay your rent and you sleep in the street. And they don't seem to have any answer for people like me whose case is different, who know that my problem really isn't alcohol, although sometimes it is. But I know it really is all these other things that make me feel different, all these strange feelings and so on. And you come to me and admit you're an alcoholic and I'm not really an alcoholic. I've got something wrong with me. There's no question about that. I've known that since I was 5 years old. But I'm not an alcoholic. And that's why it takes you a while sometimes to be around here and come to realize that the Alcoholics Anonymous steps say none of the things I just said about them. None of them say anything like that. My sponsor, who is rather cruel to me many times, because I wanted to debate with him, but he pointed out to me a number of years ago saying such things as, listen you, why don't you just try the black parts of the page, you know, just the words that are on the page. They're not interested in your goddamn opinions. And I was so upset I didn't talk to him for a day or two. Really punished him. But the first step, you hear that a lot, people say, I couldn't make the first step. I was drinking because I couldn't make the first step. As if to say the first step says that you're going to admit you're an alcoholic, you're going to stop drinking. And the first step doesn't say that. The first step is really quite clear and quite simple. The whole thing is so simple. I'm going to talk to you about this, and just how simple these things are, which are the contradiction in terms. But the first step says, as we point out, we not point out to those of you already knew, it never says you're an alcoholic. It says you admitted that you're powerless over alcohol. What does that mean? Does that mean every time you drank, you got crazy and leaped on nuns and did unspeakable things to them? No, it doesn't sound like a good idea, but I don't think about it. I shouldn't say that. But AA asks you and me to admit when we come here that we're having trouble with our drinking, that we no longer can control it on a continuing basis, that when you drink, sometimes you cannot predict your behavior. We talked about that earlier today, that it isn't that every time you drink, your hair grows long and you become a fiend, but that sometimes you drink. One of the problems I had in my life was that I could stop after work and drink and feel good and go home. But other times, I couldn't, and I know the one that couldn't was going to be, oh, that was the night of my daughter's birthday, oh, that's the night I should have been home, or that's the night I was supposed to do. You just never know. And like that analogy we used this morning about the playing Russian roulette, there's a lot of clicks when you're starting out, you can get by, but eventually the chambers get filled up and they get worse and worse. And all you got to admit when you come here, I'm having some trouble drinking. And we presume if you weren't having some trouble drinking, you wouldn't come here. People usually don't come to Alcoholics Anonymous if they don't have a problem drinking, unless they happen to be one of those people who want to sneak in. God, you know, when Dr. Bob would roll over in the grave, that people want to sneak into AA. But, you know, that's why people come to meetings, and they presume it means more than that. And they think that you have to admit that you're the worst alcoholic ever, and it doesn't say that at all. The analogy I always think about that is this woman who came to the doctor to take a pregnancy test. And she said, well, now there's no reason to think so, doctor. I've never been touched, but while I'm here, could I have one of those rabbit tests? Okay. And the doctor says, I've got some wonderful news for you, Miss Brown. Mrs. Brown? She said, no, I'm not Mrs. Brown. I'm Miss Brown. She said, I've got some bad news for you, Miss Brown. You're pregnant. She said, there can't be, doctor. I told you, I've never been touched. I've always been a very perfect girl. She started on me, man, but you're pregnant. She said, it can't be. I'll tell you, I can't. The doctor walked over to the window. She's very, very young for you. He says, the last time this happened, there was a star in the east. I don't want to miss it. People that sit in AA meetings that deny they've had any trouble drinking at all, but they're not saying that they deny that they're not extreme to the extremes they're here. They haven't been in jail 42 times or been in 19 treatment centers or something. It doesn't ask you to admit that. It asks you that I'm having some problems drinking. And a lot of other problems too, but I'm having problems drinking. And therefore my life is unmanageable. But it doesn't say that either. My sponsor at Portland, he says, you're supposed to be a writer. He told me you're a good writer. Read the first step, see what it says. It says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, dash. And the English language, dash, means end of thought, beginning of new thought. You're admitting two things. That you've had problems, you cannot control your drinking as you wish, and you're also, your life is unmanageable when you're sober. And both of these would have to be present to be here. Why would anyone ever, when you walk in the door here, you make that admission. You don't have to admit it to anybody. It's very clear, because if either one of those things weren't present, I wouldn't be here. If drinking was the problem, and my sobriety was a problem, today I would be out drinking. I wouldn't be here. I'd be drinking. I'd be having fun. If my drinking was out of hand, that I could live comfortably sober, I wouldn't be here. I'd be out living comfortably sober. It's when you cannot exist in either place. I'm having problems drinking. I'm having problems sober. And that's what makes you crazy, because you know it's not all the alcohol, it's all these other things. But the nice thing about this is, that's all you have to admit. You do not have to admit really about stuff that doesn't say to admit you're an alcoholic. You don't even have to admit to stay sober. You just have to admit, I'm having some problems drinking, and I'm having some problems sober. I'd like to tell you why. I want to know why. Thank you very much, sir. That's all there is to the first step. As you go along later, and later, you know, you're bored some years later, you want to look at the reasons why. Why is the body having this sensitivity reaction to alcohol? Why is my sobriety full of conflict? You may find those reasons, they're easy to find. But to take the first step of AA is this. I'm having problems drinking. I'm having problems sober. And that's the first step, and that's all it says, and that's all it asks. So if you do that, you are actually saying, I have alcoholism, because that's the definition of alcoholism. I'm intolerable drinking, intolerable sobriety. That's the definition of alcoholism. So there's nothing really debate there. The second step drives a lot of people away, drove me away for a long time, because now you're going to return to God. And I was raised in a very religious place up in northern Wisconsin, the Northern Lutheran Church, very strict. Our our sinners became Southern Baptists. Incidentally, I want to tell you something. I think I mentioned this morning, I woke up this morning about 4:30 and I couldn't sleep. I had terrible time. And it just struck me why. Because where I'm staying in that area, there's a whole big convention of Southern Baptists, isn't there? And that hotel is full of Southern Baptists. And I woke up 4:30 in the morning and the silence was deafening. Nobody in the distance said, "Oh, okay, I'm a big guy. Come on, honey, I want you. You're just put out, you know." But back up from deafening the silences, you can't sleep for that. That's why I couldn't sleep. I haven't been with it. Anyway, I go to the strict church, and it's a very strict church, and we were taught as children that, you know, there's certain rules you follow. You don't sin. You don't associate with Catholics. You try to live a good life. And about a little bit older, I realized that I seem to be different than most of the Asian Lutherans. Somehow I seem to need more fun than other Norwegian Lutheran kids. I got sinning. Then I got monking with Catholics. I got sinning with Catholics, actually. Which was a lot easier than I thought it would be. I knew I was in trouble by the time I was 12, 13 or 14. By the time I was 18, I realized if what they said was true, I was going to go to hell. And I stopped trying to believe in the Lutheran Church. Because if what they said was true, and there's something about that real defective, that's what they used to say. You live in your mind till you're 12, and there'll be Nazis till they're 90, somewhere down deep inside me. And I was trained in a frame of goodness, and I liked it really, but I just couldn't do it. And I always knew when I grew up, I got to be kind of a smart-talking agnostic or atheist, or sit around there and boobs and porches and say, if God exists, let him strike me dead. if God exists, why does a busload of men outside Chicago leave strung along the traffic with a bunch of dead penguins and 20 miles in all the gangsters live in luxury and go to Italy and Lucky Luciano sits in Naples with his prostitutes and booze and drugs and terrible man living comfortably and 100 miles away in Rome the Pope is screaming in pain from cancer. Is this God in action? Forget it. And that's all very good, except once in a while you wake up in the middle of the night and you know you're going to go to hell. You're going to go to hell. And you can't, as I said, you can't prove it to you in the morning. And so one of the things I feel about God, about AA, my years of slipping, sometimes I'd start to discuss it a little bit when some one of these God people would start talking. Gotta return to God now. Turn it on. Remember one time in Chicago or someplace, I had delivered a small statement on my disbelief in God. Some little lady came up and she says, "Oh, Sonny," she said, "we just hate to see you fight God." And I was thinking, it's all I could do to keep saying, "Well, ma'am, you'll never see me fight God again." Now you can just hear me fight God for a while. Well, I could stay on A a little bit, but I'm not much of one for returning to God. I know my sponsor after another one of my expositions that is moving out of Los Angeles, he wasn't there, but somebody told him about it. God, what did I hate about my sponsor? He seemed to have snitches in every meeting in the world. But he cornered me, and a couple other people cornered me, and they pointed out to me that I'm synthesizing what he's saying. He said, "For God's sakes, AA doesn't say you have to return to God." I said, "Oh, okay. Return to a power greater than myself. Does that fool your little friends? It doesn't fool me. I know what they're talking about." He said, "No, it doesn't say that either. Why don't you read the steps, for Christ's sake? Can you come to believe? You come to believe in something. If there's a power greater than yourself, can't you believe in God?" I said, "No." He said, "Can't you believe in AA?" I said, "No." He says, "You think I'm doing better than you are?" I said, "I guess so." "Congratulations, I'm your new higher power." And that's how he became my higher power this morning. And as I said this morning, I could accept that because he couldn't send me to hell. It seemed like hell sometimes, but it wasn't. And I accepted it as my higher power. And again, as I repeat what I said this morning, people say, oh, look at that guy, his sponsors, his God. And sponsor is not God, but come to believe in the power of it. You gotta come to, that step says you gotta come to believe there's a power greater than yourself. I never tried somebody one time, told my sponsor one time, I don't believe there's a power greater than myself. He says, I can prove that different. I said, how? He said, go out into the lamppost, take off all your clothes, and stand on the street corner. You'll see a power greater than yourself in a black and white car come and take you away. They don't care if you believe in them or not. That's one of the great problems of the world. It's full of powers greater than myself. The problem is to come to believe in a power greater than myself that may be benevolent. So anyway, and the next thing about it is this. You don't have to understand how any of these things are going to happen. You just have to try to come to believe in something. And what is this power that we try to believe in? What's it going to do? It's going to restore me to sanity. Well, that's a little problem there. What is sanity? Who would define sanity? You can read 10 psychiatric textbooks and you will not find an agreement on what sanity is. I used to think sanity, the guy that I was measured by, was the guy in the next bed to mine in the electric shock ward in Texas, where we were confined against our will. And he used to be happy all the time. How are you doing, my friend? Just fine, just fine. Lovely morning, isn't it? That's sanity. I didn't realize he's never going to get out of there. He starts laughing. I mean, that isn't it. Being happy all the time is not sanity. What is sanity? Well, it's hard to define sanity. Insanity, however, is easy to define. That can be defined in any textbook. Psychosis. In the insanity not caused by brain damage, but caused by psychological difficulty. And psychosis is oversimplified, but it's basically this. When the conflict of the mind, as we talked about earlier this morning, a lot of conflicts. When the conflicts sometimes get out of whack, get out so intense, can't control them, sometimes the neurosis is so intense, it just gets so self-centered, that the brain, in an effort to maintain itself, to sustain itself, to maintain itself, will set up an exit. In other words, it will make part of the perceived reality different than it is. Will alter perception of reality to change to reduce the conflict. An example of that. Instead of worrying, what are these people all talking about? Why are they talking about? And those friends, why are they talking to each other? And a form of psychosis. I now know why they're talking. They're talking about me. They're plotting against me. Which is a relief. I know it gets rid of the conflict. It may make me sick, but I understand why they're doing it now. The conflict removed. And much of psychosis is the same thing. Sometimes it's just a little bit, sometimes it's the whole thing. These people are always locked up. A lot of people have brief psychoses, and they're not locked up because they only manifest themselves when the right situation comes up. That's why you find these serial, sometimes crazed killers. Their neighbors all say, Daddy, you're such a nice guy. Very pleasant in the neighborhood here. Just had a tendency to cut off his wife's head, I guess. I don't know. When the right buttons are pushed. Okay, psychosis is it's when your brain will change your perception of reality to reduce conflict. Now, here's an interesting thing. Alcoholics almost never become psychotic. The cases of alcoholics becoming psychotic are so rare as to be almost non-existent. Now, isn't that strange? You think, you talk about people dying from alcoholic insanity. And they do. Alcoholic insanity is the second cause of death. Maybe the first cause of death, because a lot of alcoholism deaths are not listed as alcoholism when you slide across the center line or when you commit suicide and do a lot of things. But alcoholic insanity itself is not a mental condition. It's a physical condition. Everyone in this room has ever been drunk, and I assume they all have been drunk, is familiar with that fundamental thing of waking up in the morning and having a terrible thirst, and having the fire, you've got to get the fire out. Jesus, get one cold, some beer or water, something, you know. And the reason for that is because alcohol is the only substance that I know, the only fluid I know that dries out your body. It is a dehydrating substance. It goes, gets into the bloodstream and dries out cells throughout the body. And that's why you're up and you're so thirsty, you have to induce fluids, which again revive the cells. But there are two areas of the body, two organs, in which cells are dead like that, they never revive. When cells are dead, they're dead. One is the liver, one is the brain. And that is why people like us die with liver problems, and that's why we have brain problems. Now, it doesn't mean that these things suddenly just stop working. It means you've got millions of cells. It takes a lot of drinking over a long period of time. And eventually, you can, cirrhosis of the liver. Cirrhosis of the liver is caused not even so much by drinking, but not getting sufficient vitamins to revive the cells, or to protect the cells. But in the brain, it's all alcohol. You lose enough brain cells and you have alcoholic insanity. Also called Korsakoff syndrome. Also caused a wet brain. But it really is a dry brain, it's ironic. And I think you may think that you see people on the news now, crap, that's a misguided, a wet brain, you guys are so crazy. But people with this condition, you won't see them at meetings, and you won't see them acting silly in bars. Because they're not there. Well, probably most of you will never see a case of it. I see them all the time. I wish I didn't. People with dried-out alcoholic brains are sitting in the ward, sitting on the bed or on the chair, and they come and change their diapers three times a day, and they feed them, and they put them to bed, and they get them up, and they feed them, and they change their diapers. And this goes on day after day, after week, after month, after year. It's very much like the last stages of syphilis, except syphilis has the decency to kill the patient. In alcoholic insanity, you can sit like that, the rest of your body's healthy. You last 40 years sometimes, 40, 50 years. And once a year, your family will come down, hoping against hope you'll know them, and you don't, so they cry and go home. That's what alcoholic insanity is. But alcoholics never, if ever, become psychotic. They become alcoholic, Korsakoff syndrome, but not psychosis, where your brain is, why? Because when it gets bad enough, long enough, I will drink alcohol and alter my perception of reality. A very excellent case for me, I'd debate all day. But as an alcoholic, I can induce temporary psychosis. I can change reality. And I have the ability to do that, and so I will not ever be confronted with a brain strikes against it. And I will do it again and again. That's what this book talks about, in that phrase where it says, there's going to be time when there's no adequate defense against the first drink. You're not aware of it, but you are drinking to preserve your sanity. Sometimes it's bad. Now, what do you think it means it's going to restore me to sanity? Maybe it means just exactly what it would say. That somehow it's going to restore me to living in a world where I do not have to induce psychosis to stem it. Where I do not have to induce temporary insanity to weather the conflicts. And it isn't going to do it by making my mind stronger. It's going to do it by finding ways where I can reduce the conflict. Somehow. We're talking to lunch today about willpower. Why can't I do the same thing with willpower? Well, the brain has the power, the power of the human will, and much of my life has been spent, I'm sure much of your life, in dealing with emotions that seem to get so strong and out of hand and getting in problems. I could just, damn it, keep those damn emotions in check, that's how I'd be all right. And there's always a conflict between these two. And as the years go by, they get more intense. I'll tell you a little truism. When intense emotions are in battle against the power of the mind, the will, the emotions eventually always win. And that's why the brain this time walks away and all hell you go. And it's very difficult. You come to AA and you think, well, maybe AA is going to somehow strengthen my will, strengthen my power to control these damn emotions. And it does for a while, but eventually the emotions win. And yet there are people who have never learned to do this. How do you do this? Why is this? And it turned out to be very strange, so you only see it in retrospect, really. AA offers very little to my brain, very little to my conscious knowledge, except in retrospect. What AA does is have me take actions that reduce the pressure of the emotions, coming at it from the other direction. So I eventually am able to control my emotions, not by strengthening my will, but by reducing the intensity of the emotions, to reduce that conflict. So, somehow I got to come to believe, somehow, in some way, I can't see how to do it, but you don't have to know how to do it. You have to just believe by looking at the people ahead of you, they've done it. But somehow there's a power of the way it is by sponsor meetings, to help us not God. It's going to restore me to being able to live in the world without having to drink to stand it. I can't see how that can be, because I can't possibly understand how much pain I have. But the nice thing about it is you don't have to understand anything about it. All you have to do is try to come to believe that the power of greater than yourself, whatever that power may be, will restore your sight. You can try to come to believe that, you've just taken the second step. That's all there is to it. That's all it says. That's all it says in the second step. You don't have to see how it's going to be done. So now I got some problem drinking. I got some problem sober. That means you don't have to drink. And now I got to somehow come to be with some power here. It should be ridiculous. Is going to be able to live in the world by having a great standard. But Jesus, I don't know how. You don't know how. First step's quite simple. This is one that drives a lot of people away. Well, turn your problems over to God. Now, you and I both know that doesn't work. That's ridiculous. That's nice for old, good people, maybe. Well, I took my problem to Jesus, then. I didn't have any rent money. I went to Jesus, and the next day, a check came in the mail for an old insurance policy. I knew the program worked. Probably you speak me crazy if you're stories like that. I heard a guy talking, he goes, I was riding in the club car of this train. And I was having a few drinks, and somebody's almost like heard a voice say, put that drink down and go back to your home. I thought, what does this mean? But I went back to my home, and an hour later, that train derailed, and people in the club car were killed. And I knew that God was teaching me a lesson about my drinking. And my reaction is, what is God teaching those poor bastards in the club car? How to die just so you can feel better? Screw that. If God is like that, I don't want any part of it. I don't go for this God stuff. I can't accept that. Because if God is judging people on their worthiness and merits, I am screwed. I'm not even going to think about that. And a few people say, I'm here by the grace of God. Which implies that other people out there don't have the grace of God, I guess. And God's going to you and say, you can say something, you can't. You can, but you too can't. You can, maybe you can, I'm not sure yet. Well, yeah. If that's the case, I can't stay sober, because I would never be the one anybody would choose, because I'm a sinner, bad, loser, failure, dreadful person. And I could not accept the fact that turn my will and my life over to the care of God. That's ridiculous. I would not do that. I went along in AA for a while. And like about 6 months sober, I was still sober somehow, off and on, mostly by being intimidated by my sponsor, and the occasional pat on the back. And I got a job as a dishwasher. I had other jobs I lost. A guy put in some clout and got me a job as a dishwasher, which is not really what you should have to have after 6 months of riding to have clout to get a job as a dishwasher. And I lasted about 2 days at that dirty delicatessen on Sunset. I got thinking about that. I was watching, it seemed to me the waiters, the death boys were bringing in more dishes than the waiters were taking out. I begin to deduce these waiters are getting dishes in other restaurants to humiliate me because I'm an Anglo. I stocked a few dishes, didn't look too bad. Dishes over there, I didn't do them. They take you just exactly where you got them, Jose. And turns out I discharged the rear dishes, but Boston was going to use it. So they said, I have to let you go tonight, kid. Of course, by this time I'd been around 87 or 6 months, so I'd learned some of the AE pattern, but I hadn't picked up all the other ones I was slipping. Yeah. Oh, I'm an alcoholic anonymous. I'm trying to find a new life. You better give me another chance. I'm working 12 steps here. I'm finding a new life. I'm changing my life. He said something really true. He said, I don't give a shit about all that. You just don't wash your dishes. That's all. I thought about that many, many times since then. A lot of times I didn't feel like giving them go to work, so I was up talking to somebody in the middle of the night. Or I was tired. I'd driven all the way to India to talk to 10 Indians and come back. And these other people just went home and said, I'm tired. I should be able to come in early. Now I was thinking, people out there, they don't care what I did last night. They just want me to wash my dishes, you know. Be where you're sitting, where you're going to be there. It's not just hurtful, but it's really true. But anyway, I got fired. I lost my job. And I decided to commit suicide. And I didn't know what else to do. I thought, I'll just kill myself. I've always been good at suicide. I've tried to commit suicide so many times I started to damage my health. But I decided to throw myself in the ocean that day. And I started walking out there, and I walked so far, gee, I got tired. I stopped the guy and said, where's the ocean? He said, well, you're just in Western Beverly Hills. I went past the Veterans Hospital and about another 3 miles after that. I called up my sponsor, and he... Why should I write your damn inventory? Like I told you. And I had just told him the week before, I've taken my inventory with a psychiatrist. What did I want to do with an auto work actor? What could that do for me? That made him cross. So I said, that made him cross. Are you mad judging about that? The last thing in the world. Are you mad judging about the remorse and pain and everything? Are you mad judging about that? He says, and you're judgment. Who cares about your judgment? You live in the abandoned car, for Christ's sake. If I wanted your judgment, I'd put my head in the back window and ask you for it. Well, that's a hurtful thing to say to a sensitive guy. He got this upset the day that I came, went back in. I jumped out of the telephone, skipping up short left, I'd made the ocean in 3 bounds on the other way. I got back to the ocean, and I called him, he's in paper, I'm going to go, I wrote, oh God, I wrote terrible things I'd never told anybody, just, oh, I was so upset. And that group said, why don't you tell your psychiatrist these things, because when you pay that kind of money, you can't risk rejection, that's why. I'd like the guy to say, you did what, sir? Get out of my office and first wash off that chair. You know. And I took an inventory. And a week later, I was really bad again, and he took me for a ride along the ocean from Santa Monica to Oxnard, about 30 miles, and gave me a flashlight, and had me read it through. By that time, I'm not sure I want to talk about all of these things. Just read it. I read these terrible things from my family. Actually, I thought, he's going to make me get out of this car and maybe turn me into the police for all I know. And the old fool was just yawning. That made him crazy. But I've taken him through over 200 times since then on the driver's side. And some other puke over there with a flashlight. Now let me explain this part before I read it. And it's an amazing thing. All of a sudden. But I look back and I realize, I suppose that's when I took the third step. When I surrendered my will to do something I absolutely didn't want to do because I was in such pain. Nothing helps you, I don't think, surrender quite as much as pain. Love is nice, but you get strong by pain, overcoming pain. I look back now, and I would think to myself, I've learned to surrender to a power greater than myself, and I allow him to do it by taking a fourth step. I suppose the fourth step probably is the great dividing line, always will be in Alcoholics Anonymous, between people who are going to do it and people who are postponing it. The fourth step is, and they have different ways of doing it. They have that diagram in the book, which is good. It was a state of the art in 1939, when you read the book, and maybe it's now. Over the years, I've just learned, because for my own personal use, I have, for the people I sponsor, I've looked up some questions that I asked them to answer thoroughly, and discovered, say, like maybe I'll get a good inventory. It's nothing deep psychological thing, just questions I think I've won. And looking back over your life today, what memories are still painful, are still guilty, are still dirty? To today, what ways do you feel inadequate as a person? Be it. Three, who do you resent and why? Be as specific as possible and nasty to really show what you really feel. Four, what do you conceive to be your defects of character as far as you can determine? Five, what is the nature of your ongoing problems you have with people close to you, family, people you love, and so on? What seems to be the recurring things that happen? Six, what are your goals today as you see them, realistic or not? Just list what are your goals as far as you can see? And seven, do you see that any way that AA can begin to help you start toward these goals? And if you write, in my experience, if you write those things, and thoroughly, some of them write many, many pages just on the first question, you'll have written a good inventory. One of the great problems with an inventory is knowing what to write. Because so often, you sit down and you wind up with a biography, a 40-page biography, not what you're trying to get. We're trying to, as the step says, we're trying to find out our defects of character. We're trying to make an inventory of ourselves so we can evaluate how we are. And to do that is not offensive if you're thinking about taking an inventory. An inventory is not supposed to make you feel better. If you've taken an inventory, it should make you feel worse. Because you're confronting all sorts of crap that you've been burying, ignoring, and putting aside. You go to an inventory, oh, Jesus. And then you take hopefully you take a fifth step. Some people are so ashamed to do a fourth step, they never take it. Never take a fifth step, which is just the absolute opposite of what you should do, because you're not going to feel good after the fourth step. If you feel good, it's going to be after the fifth step. And yet people are so afraid of this, they're so convinced they are different, that they're afraid to read the inventory, afraid to write it down even. But then you take a fifth step, and now I know different people do it different ways. Some parts of the country they have clergymen. Everybody goes and takes their inventory without clergymen. Some people go 100 miles to talk to a priest that they don't know, but take their inventory. Some people have their counselors. Where I live, it is a custom to take an inventory with your sponsor. And they say, well, gee, what if my, should I put my hands on the hands of a Christian who might get drunk and blab about it? I've never heard of that happening, ever, ever. But I'm asking this guy to save my life and to give me direction to save my life, but I'm not willing for him to tell him about myself. Are you not stupid? He's supposed to give me directions without me giving any data except what I choose he needs to have. So I think you're taking inventory with your sponsor. But theoretically what happens is you take your fifth step. After you take your fifth step, he or she shares a little bit with you to help you understand you're nowhere near as different as you feel. I suppose that's the greatest fear of everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, or outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, who's not calling. But I am different. My case is different. I'm just different. The greatest trick today is to discover you're not so different, little by little. And suddenly you realize you're just like everybody else. So I talked about this morning. I've been in meetings, over the years I've been coming to ask to speak in exotic places like Cape Town, South Africa, and Australia. I'll be there again in a couple of months, and Berlin, and Paris, and Ireland. Last September I went to Norway. God, was that wonderful. I was in power. First time I was ever in a place where there was a majority of Norwegian Lutherans. And I felt strong. We found a little old Catholic lady and just kicked the hell out of her. She was plotting something, I could tell. She was fingering some beads of some kind. But it's an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing. You always come to think you find exotic alien, exotic people, and except for the accents, you hear exactly the same thing you are hearing in Los Angeles. The same things, the same feelings, the same troubles, the same cares, the same. Remember sitting in, I was in Berlin about 3 weeks after the war came back, and I, as a fact, I went up to that wall and they gave me a little hammer and a chipper, and I chipped off pieces of the wall. I brought it home, gave my grandsons, and said, "Here, John and Joe, this is proof that I love you more than your other grandfather does." Well, I can't do it when you can. You can just give money and all that. But you know, and I sat down and I spoke very big, speaking at dinner on Saturday night. I went for a Friday night English speaking meeting, and they had some Germans come in from East Germany. They even had two guys from Czechoslovakia there who'd come to, for that weekend. And that was funny. Let me tell you this. Mr. Pat told me to get off the subject this morning. I told him to shut up. Anyway. But just as an aside thing, in Czechoslovakia, up until the war, until there was AA. But as they explained to us, through a series of little groups, and they each had only two people in them. I said, "Why do you only have two people?" He said, "Because under the laws of the state, any group of three or more who discussed God was a conspiracy against the state. So they had two people in a group." I thought, "Well, that wouldn't be bad if I was the old timer. You come, set up both chairs, make coffee, I'll come and speak, and then you clean up." Again and again and again. But I spoke in Berlin, and I thought, you know, I'll do something to do. These Germans are coming through the gate where these spies used to go to. And we lived about freedom from alcohol, and freedom from Soviet tyranny, and freedom from fear. And a voice that's true, that little voice behind me saying, "But I don't think you really understand. I'm afraid my case is different." Yes, I would have heard that in Santa Monica. I'd have to go to Germany to hear that. And that's what's so important about the fourth and fifth step of getting your stuff out, because you start to realize eventually that you're not so different. All these things are to overcome difference. I suppose the fourth step is a great turning spot, not because of everything except that I cannot believe this stuff isn't me, this filth is not unique unto me. And that's where the third step comes in. That is where you do the third step by doing the fourth step. That's the ricochet effect is this. I can't drink. I've had trouble drinking. Having trouble sober. Somewhere there is a power greater than me that's going to destroy me. Say, I can't see it to be. But then, I'm going to do what that power says, whether I agree with it or not. That is the crisis point. Everyone can talk. But am I willing to do something that I'm afraid of, that I know is going to make me look bad, going to make me look unnatural, they're going to find out about me, I can't trust anybody, and do it anyway. Just because people ahead of me who I can admire say I should. And that's all it takes. There's that first step that I think people out here are really quite simple. I'm going to have some problem drinking, I'm going to have some problem sober. Somewhere there's a power here, I don't know if it's that light pole out there, or my sponsor, or God, or Jesus, who knows, that will enable me to not have to drink to stand it. And as frightening as it is, I'm going to try it. It's funny when we come here with desperation, I think that's so terrible, yet the desperation is the best friend you got. The desperation will make you do things you'd never do for love, or mommy, or nobody else. And you take these actions, and you have a fearless and thorough moral inventory. There are people who say, around AA, they say, "Well, you shouldn't just have an inventory of your bad things, you should have the good things. Let me just write a input positive things. And maybe you should. But there's no step to take care of that. The first step just deals with the nature of our wrongs. I just have to write a new step. And to admire the nature of my rights, I guess. This, unload this crap. We don't have to tell each other. I'm not so bad. That's why, in my experience, I'm to start to get better. Thank you. Are there any questions on the first five steps? Don't feel bad, don't feel ill at ease. If you say something that makes you sound silly, I'll turn on you. What? Thank you very much. That's a good question. Let me explain how that works. I was born in a trunk in the Princess Theater.
My question is, how come the steps are written in past tense?
How come the steps are written in past tense? Because they're coming. They've taken them already when they wrote them.
Oh,
Pat, get the car started. I'll be out in a minute. Well, it was written, the 12 of 12 was written in 1954. 50 years. But why would that have? She said, but why were the steps written in the past tense, as they are there, written in the book? Go to your room. Oh. Hey, that's it. If you'd share with me, I'd like to ask you a question. You want to share something? I get the feeling like, I know what Daddy Warbucks looks like. It, looking at the whole room of orphan and just round circles for eyes. Huh?
Okay, what if you somebody sponsoring and
they're
just like drawing for months and months and months and months on the
fourth
step? What do you think?
Well, that is very unnatural, very unusual. In my experience, when I have people like that, I have people like that from time to time. I just do not listen to the recitation of troubles anymore. Funny. I don't give a shit about your inventory. Like my sponsor said to me, I'm going to kill myself. That's your inventory. Then you have to decide, what do I do? I'll flip a coin. Kill myself, then the inventory. Equally. That is so unusual. What do you do when you have people who won't let your inventory in? Maggie?
Exact same thing. I just tell them, well, just don't tell me of the problems you're having between now and when you decide.
Yeah, I just said that.
That's the answer.
But you know, but there are people like that. I was afraid, you know, they're just instinctively afraid. I know all the reasons why I should, but I just can't. Yes, sir.
How many people do you know that
have
stayed sober and happy without doing
this? Not very many. I know that, I'll tell you an example of that. I know people who stayed sober. When I was about 5 years sober, and I was about 6 months ago, I started to pay meetings. When I went to a meeting, and a guy named Larry Blake, I think his name was talking. He was 23 years sober. He said, get the dream. This guy said, there are people out there who tell you have to write inventory. Well, I didn't write a damn inventory, and I've been sober 23 years. And I'm tired of hearing that kind of talk. On the way home, this kid says to me, geez, you say you have to write inventory. And he says, I didn't. He's 23 years sober. I said, I listen to you. And I had no answer. I said, I'll get back to you. And the middle of the night, the answer came. I called him in the morning. I said, I knew the answer all along. I just didn't want to tell you last night what you'd think about it. I said, you look at the way he feels. Is that the way you want to feel when you're 23 years sober? I know how to feel that way sober when I was sober 2 days. Yes, I'm sober. The old time is all over AA's. Listen to all this crap. You come here and you stop drinking. You go to meetings. You hear that? And you find love, you son of a bitch. I this, in my opinion, I don't know any alcoholics of our type who would stay sober and feel good without getting some of that crap out. There may be people who do, and I'm sure they do, or something like that, but not of our type. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Now, you said that,
no, I didn't say you should. I said I'd do it on my part of the country to do that. But
so if the only question I have is that I did do my business for my sponsor, but I can't admit that I did hold some things back for the fact that there are things that I think I better tell somebody who doesn't see
we all have things like that, Jim. That's what you tell your sponsor. You're not telling your sponsor is acting as God for, you know, so I'm going to a priest. I don't tell the priest, who am I telling God? When you're back to confession, God is acting for the priest. I believe God works through your sponsor. He may not even know it. I don't mean that he's a wonderful God-like creature, but that's the way I think that is exactly what we're talking about this morning. I understand that fear better than you know, and I also know that it's better to do it than to say, well, I'm feeling bad, waiting for the right person to tell it to. And you might just call and say, I got a few things I'd like to mention to you. I twist baby chicken's necks. I used to be married to a sheep outside of Butte, Montana. Things that you just should not have generally known in the population. Yes, sir.
I'm going to give this story about how long the fourth step was, how short it is, and when you had it
coming up. Thank you. Step? No, I know people who are troubled who write long. That's why I put those questions out, so at least there's some delineation of what's. Because I think the real long inventory gets to be one of two things, either internal biography or going over the same things again and again and again and again and again, and both of like you get to the first makes the listener crazy after a while, you know. I don't know, I would say that it's impossible to say. I've just been in the 12th and the 5 pages long, and it just didn't pay much, and also in the 20 pages long, it really didn't have any more in, and they didn't. I just think you have to write down the things that are bothering you. And if it takes 10 pages to do it, good. If it takes 20 pages, just don't tell me the same thing over and over again. Like the old story about the woman going to confession and talking about being raped by 3 men. And the father said, when did this happen? She said, 41 years ago. He said, you have to keep confessing it. She said, I just like to think about it. Yeah. It's the same thing. You just get it out and let it go. Come on, give me another question. I'd like to have some more coffee. Could I write down those questions?
Yeah,
for a dollar. That's why I went through them fast. I think it would be somebody you could remember. I'll be back up here. They're not from Bill Wilson's forehead. They're just my experience that I found helps. Because the hardest thing, one of the hardest things I've ever done is sitting down and putting a pencil on the paper and knowing what to write. Because you said, what's that? No, I better not say that. No, maybe. Well, I was born, if you have specific essay questions to answer, I'll tell you what, it makes it a lot easier. All right, come in and join the silent meditation, sir.
I've been around 16 years.
I'm going to tell you something about that question right now. When someone says, I've been around this program about 16 years, the immediate question is, how long have you been sober this time?
Months. For me, 3 months.
3 months, okay. So that's the line I used all my life. I've been around about 9 years. How long have you been sober? 2 days. Sorry, I'm not putting you down for it. I'm just explaining it. Just
I've done many forms steps. I've done them several different ways. I've recently been asked, well, maybe I'm not doing my 4 steps right because I'm still relapsing.
Well, maybe you're not acting. Maybe it's not the 4th step. And the 4th step is your identification, but then you have to start doing something about it. A 4th step will not keep you sober, only the 5th step. the ensuing steps of the amends, making amends, the going through being of service to others, that's where you stay sober. The fourth and fifth step just get that shit out, you know. If the fourth and fifth step should be sober, psychiatry would keep you sober. I'm going to talk a little more about this afternoon, so we're going to talk about the rest of the steps, and then we'll talk about it. I'm not at all putting it on, you understand that? You remind me of me as well.
Get out of here.
Anybody else? Okay, folks. I'm buying the drinks.